This is Bob E. equals MC Square Hope again. Where was I? Oh, yes. You see this piece of white shiny metal about the size of, say, a package of cigarettes? See this piece in my other hand about the same size? Both are hunks of pure uranium. Now hold on to your seats. That's an atomic explosion. Why? What has man done to these two pieces of metal? Question number two is, what the devil is Hope doing talking about the atom?
This is Bob Trout in the NBC newsroom. Let me take 20 seconds to tell you about Mr. Hope and the atom. We call this series The Quick and the Dead. Tonight, the second of four transcribed programs based on Mr. Hope, just an average guy discovering the atom bomb.
And don't forget the hydrogen bomb.
Sorry, Bob, and the hydrogen bomb. Several weeks ago, Bob was in New York and one day decided he wanted to learn more about atomic energy. So we in the newsroom sent him to see William Lawrence of the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and the only reporter allowed backstage at the building of the bomb.
Lawrence held me spellbound, and I figured if he could make me understand it, anybody could get it. On last week's show, we went as far as 1942. At Stagg Field, Chicago, our scientists put enough pure uranium together to get a chain reaction going. A chain reaction meant that an atomic explosion was a distinct possibility. Is that right, Bill?
That's right, Bob.
Okay, let's get on with the bomb.
It was still a big gamble. At the rate the Stagg Field file had been built, one single combat bomb would have taken 2,000 years to build.
But everything was taking so much time. What about the Germans? What were they doing?
That's what was in the back of every scientist's mind when they heard Goebbels ranting about secret weapons. Could we win the race? We all remember Dr. Einstein's warning.
Dear President Roosevelt, I understand that Germany has actually stopped the sale of uranium from the Czechoslovakian mine that she has taken over.
The Germans needed other elements besides uranium. To Hitler's atom bomb project, heavy water was also a vital ingredient.
Oh, now, wait a minute, Professor. What's heavy water?
I'll tell you about that, Bob, when we take up the hydrogen bomb. Let's just go along now by saying that heavy water was what the Nazis were pinning all their hopes on. It was worth its weight in diamonds.
Ever since 1940, British and American espionage teams had been watching the German heavy water operation at Vermont, Norway. In 1942, the Germans were forcing 3,000 pounds a year out of the plant. In 1943, it was stepped up to 10,000 pounds. In February of 1943, the Allies sent a team of Norwegians back to their native land in one of the most dangerous missions of the entire war.
My name is Gunnerseid. I was the leader of a party of six Norwegians who dropped into Norway. Our mission was to destroy the heavy water plant at Värmer. We landed in a wind-driven snow at midnight, 16th February 1943. 5 days now, and the snowstorm still rages. Visibility zero. Two hands sick with cold. All of us very weary, slowly making our way toward the plant.
5 days later, the Norwegian team was at last able to see the massive smokestacks of the heavy water plant.
February 23rd. Klaus is to lead the way down the river and up the railroad tracks. We have practiced the attack on models for weeks in London. Every man knows his position. If a man is about to be taken prisoner, he must take his own life. 30 minutes past midnight, beginning of the 24th. Finally, I began to place the charge. Everything was as our model had showed. We checked the entire charge once again. We lit both fuses. Then we made a run for it. Down through the entrance, out onto the railroad tracks. 20 yards outside the basement, we heard the explosion.
The TNT charge did the rest. The plant was completely destroyed.
Meanwhile, the war had moved into high gear. The invasion of North Africa was underway. Hitler's armies were at the gates of Stalingrad. And the Manhattan District, the code name for America's atomic energy program, was officially activated.
My name is Keller, Army Engineers. I spent 3 years in the Belgian Congo thinking I was sweating out the silliest mission of the war, mining uranium. Uranium was not a rare metal. It used to cost a couple of bucks a pound if anybody would take it. Suddenly, we were shipping hundreds of tons per day. Atom bombs? We never heard of such a thing.
That's where the manufacturing of the bomb starts, Bob. Uranium comes out of the mines mixed with other ores. Black, dirty, and contaminated. Pitch blend, they call it. Meanwhile, in February of 1943, the most fabulous city ever dreamed by man rose from a barren plain. Oak Ridge was open for business.
I am K.D. Nichols, district engineer of the Manhattan District. Until 1943, I didn't know what $1 billion was, let alone $2 billion.
In the heart of the Tennessee Valley Authority, between the Smokies and the Cumberland Mountains, is Oak Ridge. The local inhabitants, working the worn-out land using methods of the past, were suddenly projected into the 21st century.
My job was security. They called us the creeps.
That's Colonel Bill Considine.
At Oak Ridge, we had to build magnets, each one about half the size of a city block. We needed copper, almost unlimited copper, with which to wind these magnets. And with the war on, there just wasn't that much copper in the world. Silver, as you know, is just as good or even better a conductor of electricity as copper. So we called the mint in Washington and borrowed $400 million worth of silver to wind the magnets with. We moved the silver by flat car, and to this day, those magnets at Oak Ridge are still wound with silver. We used to call it the sub-treasury.
It was the best use any silver was ever put to.
Oh, that's a great story, Bill, but what exactly were they doing at Oak Ridge? Was that the atom bomb factory?
No, Bob. The actual factory was at Los Alamos. Oak Ridge was the source of pure uranium. General Motors, for example, makes cars in Detroit, where they get their steel from Pittsburgh. Oak Ridge had the enormous task of taking the raw uranium and turning it into usable 235 and then shipping it to the factory at Los Alamos to be fabricated into bombs.
All right, Bill, we were on our way. What was holding up the show? We can do anything in America, can't we?
Anything but outwit the sheer cussedness of nature.
What happened?
They suddenly discovered that you can't split all uranium. Only a special kind. Uranium-235.
So, what's the problem? Let's get some uranium-235.
That was the rub. Uranium-235 and uranium-238 come together. They're twins, just like Twiddledum and Twiddledee. Shaped alike, look alike, and they go together. They are inseparable.
Oh, now let me get that.
Get this. The scientists discovered that we could use only the lighter one. Only the uranium-235.
But you said they couldn't be separated.
That was why Oak Ridge was built. To do just that job. To get enough pounds of uranium-235 without 238 in it. When we could get a few pounds of that, we could assemble a bomb.
Well, is that where the big magnets come in?
Exactly, Bob. That's why we had to borrow the $400 million worth of silver. You can thank Professor Ernest Lawrence for that.
We call those giant magnets racetracks. They were half the size of a city block. On the inside of the track, we had vats with vaporized pure uranium in them, heated to a temperature of several thousand degrees. Then we sprayed this hot uranium from a sprinkler inside the racetrack across the magnet. In the magnet apparatus itself, we had a series of containers, each with two small holes in it. One hole was near the edge, the other a few inches further away. This is what happened. The hot uranium in a thin blue stream would start across the magnet, Tweedledum and Tweedledee going through the air together. But immediately as they crossed the magnet, the stream would be pulled down, The light atoms coming down at one place, heavy atoms going a little further, dropping into another hole. We had trapped them separately, atom by atom. In one barrel, we had unlimited amounts of the unusable 238. But in the other, we had just a speck of the precious lighter U-235. At the end of a day, we'd have perhaps a fraction of an ounce. It took thousands and thousands of hours for each barrel to collect a single ounce of the usable uranium. But we had many magnets and thousands of barrels. Slowly, oh, so slowly, we were scraping together sufficient uranium-235 to make a bomb.
But supposing we didn't get enough together, weren't we putting all our eggs in one basket?
That's where General Groves deserves a lot of credit. At Oak Ridge, he tried Lawrence's magnetic method, and they also set up a gaseous diffusion method under Professor Dunning of Columbia. If either worked, we would have a bomb. But even that wasn't enough insurance. A third plant was set up at Hempford in the state of Washington.
For making sure we had enough uranium for an atom bomb.
I didn't say uranium, Bob. I said material. At Hempford, they were not making uranium, but plutonium.
More physics. Go ahead, take 60 seconds.
I can do it in 30, Bob. Plutonium is a derivative of uranium.
Of the precious kind, or can you use the wet kind, the U-238?
238. The kind we have most of, thank the Lord. Professor McMillan, just a youngster, discovered that plutonium also might be used in a bomb. Plutonium is the first element man ever learned to make himself. You take uranium and add one neutron, and it becomes neptunium.
Then what do you do?
Nothing. You leave it alone, and in about 3 days, neptunium turns into plutonium. Just like cider turning into vinegar.
But what about Robert Oppenheimer? I thought he was one of the big shots in this story.
He was, Mr. Hope. But his time had not yet arrived. Oppie, as we called him, was setting up the factory for assembling the bomb at Los Alamos. But in 1943 and 1944, it was still all on paper. They were like soldiers with broomsticks for guns. There still wasn't enough uranium-235 or plutonium to put together a bomb.
And still the millions kept going up.
That's right. And every once in a while, even Stimson and Conant, who had given the go-ahead, would get a little nervous and wonder. Supposing we bang those two hunks of metal together and nothing happens. For a time, Robert Patterson, Undersecretary of War, got nervous over the billions of dollars he and Stimson were authorizing and sent out a special investigator named Madigan to check it.
Mr. Secretary, you and Mr. Stimson got nothing to worry about. If this thing works, they won't investigate anything. And if it doesn't work, they won't investigate anything else.
And all this time, all this remained a complete secret.
Those at Oak Ridge didn't know there was a Hempford. Hempford didn't know about Los Alamos. It was already June of 1944, and the war seemed to be passing them by.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower, people of Western Europe. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
And in June of 1944, long before the first uranium or plutonium was shipped to Los Alamos, a special B-29 combat group was activated. Its leader, Colonel Paul Tibbetts, age 29.
Gentlemen, welcome to the 509th and to Wendover Field. As you know, this is a special group. I wish I could tell you something. I can only tell you that we will train and train and train. Someday you will all know why.
At Los Alamos, Professor Oppenheimer and his boys waited for the first purified uranium. And from now on, Bob, when I say uranium, I mean uranium or plutonium, both were used. Finally, early in 1945, the first cubes, like cubes of sugar, began coming through.
I was a courier. Must have made 30 trips from Oak Ridge to Los Alamos. Never knew what it was I carried in a case strapped to my wrist. Sometimes I went by plane. Sometimes by special car. Sometimes by train. Wasn't until they dropped the bomb that I knew what I was carrying.
I was one of Oppie's boys. Watched the Wizard of Los Alamos do his job. This was the inner sanctum of the whole deal. Our job was the easiest to explain and the hardest to do. To make a bomb, you simply take some uranium, as pure as possible, and slap two pieces together as quickly as possible. That much we knew. There were only three things we didn't know. One, how much do you have to bring together, a pound or 100 pounds? We call that the critical mass. Two, how to design a container and a trigger mechanism to bring the two hunks of uranium together over the target. And three, how do you hold the two hunks together long enough to get a real explosion and not just a dud?
Oh, now, wait a minute. Hold everything, Bill. What does he mean, hold the bomb together? I thought we wanted to blow it up.
That's right, Bob. But the big problem was this. You slap the two pieces of uranium together, like that. We split an atom, and that starts that chain reaction we've been talking about.
That's right, and we have an atomic bomb.
Correct. But if you want something to take your breath away, just listen to this.
We call our job at Los Alamos extending the generations. The two pieces of uranium come together, there's a chain reaction, they fly apart, and there's an explosion which takes 1 millionth of a second. Get that. 1 millionth of a second. But such an explosion would give us a force equal to only 20 tons of TNT. And you can get that from any ordinary blockbuster.
So, what's the point? We can't spend $2 billion just for a blockbuster. We had those already.
That's right. But listen.
We knew, however, that for every tenth of a millionth of a second more, if you can hold those two hunks together, you increase the power of the bomb by 1,000. At Los Alamos, we learned a way to hold it together for that tenth of a millionth of a second longer. And we put together a bomb that could do the work of 20,000 tons of TNT.
Then that timing business is the payoff.
Exactly, Bob. The longer you can hold the two pieces of uranium together, the more efficient a bomb you get. There can be no bigger bombs than those built at Los Alamos. All you can do to improve the bomb is to...
I know. Prolong that millionth of a second that you hold them together.
You astound me, Bob. Absolutely correct.
Of course, how they did that is a secret.
Perhaps the biggest secret of them all. Well, they did all three jobs at Los Alamos. And as Oppie said,
each component did exactly what it was expected to do. Failure of any one of these would have meant failure of the whole.
Finally, on July 16, 1945, Los Alamos had enough uranium to make a final test, and the first atom bomb was tested. We took up the New Mexico test last week, and you know, of course, that it worked. All that remained now was to slap these two pieces of uranium together over an enemy target. Meantime, uranium was rushed to the cruiser Indianapolis, which hoisted anchor and sailed for Tinian on the very same day as the Los Alamos explosion.
Early on Monday morning, July 16th at 05:30, reveille was sounded for all of us hands of the Indianapolis to get out of our sacks and make preparations for getting underway. But just before we left, a big wooden box was brought aboard. It was guarded from the time it came aboard until it was taken off. We knew it was something very important because we were going to make a high-speed run to Tinian in the Marianas.
Other bomb material, not yet ready, went in three heavy bombers whose pilots were unaware of their cargo. At Potsdam, Germany, couriers brought the news to Truman and Churchill, who told Stalin. On August 5th, The weather reports were favorable. Colonel Tibbetts was finally able to brief his boys.
Well, boys, tonight is the night we've all been waiting for. The bomb we're going to drop is different from any that you've ever heard about. It contains a destructive force equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Three planes will fly the mission. The Enola Gay to carry the bomb. The primary target is Hiroshima.
That same day, an important change was made in the plan of operations. Some of the Los Alamos scientists and Captain Dick Parsons, whose job it was to load the bomb and set the delicate mechanisms, watched several B-29s crash and take off. Parsons went to General Farrell and said,
"General, some of our scientists are quite worried about the possibility of a crash on takeoff with a bomb on board."
"So, Deke, if that happens, we lose the plane, the crew, the bomb, you and the whole darn island. You just pray that that doesn't happen."
"Well, it couldn't happen if I made the final assembly of the bomb in the bomb bay after we take off."
"Deke, have you ever done a final assembly like that before?"
"No, but I've got all day to practice."
"You mean when that plane left Tinian, the bomb wasn't all set?"
"No. And don't think we didn't think of that as we watched the Enola Gay take off and head for Hiroshima. As soon as the mission was airborne, we raced to the communications center where we could talk with Colonel Tibbetts by radio and ask how Parsons was getting on with his assembly job. When we lost contact with the Enola Gay, he was still out in the bomb bay, his skilled fingers working on the delicate trigger mechanism.
I looked down at my hands. They were dirty, greasy hands, just as if I had fixed the carburetor and distributor of my car.
Bob Lewis, the plane's co-pilot, kept a log of the mission, a priceless document.
"It is 7:30. Parsons has put the final touches on his assembly job. We are now loaded. The bomb is alive. We start to climb to our final altitude at 7:40. Won't be long now. We have now set the automatic pilot for the last time until bombs away. Now it is 8:30. Dick Nelson, our radio operator, has just received a report from one of our weather planes. Hiroshima, our primary target, is clear. We are now ready for the final bomb run. It is 8:50. Not long now. There will be a short intermission now while we bomb our target."
Tom Ferriby, bombardier. "The Enola Gay had a 4-minute run over the perfectly open target. I manipulated the crosshairs of the bomb sight until the target was at the intersection of the course line and the rate line. The great bomb bay doors swung open. I synchronized and let go.
The inert mass suspended in the interior came to life, freed itself, leaped out. Still, the two hunks of uranium were at opposite ends of the bomb. Down it hurtled. Eternal seconds passed. It was exactly 9:15:00. Those inside the plane watched for a signal. Then it came, like a tiny light on a switchboard, a little pinpoint of purplish red light. Oppenheimer's trigger had slapped the two hunks of uranium together and held them so for that tenth of a millionth of a second.
The blue-white flash immediately grew into a giant ball of fire a half mile in diameter.
One of Fermi's neutrons had entered one atom. One atom had forced two neutrons into two more atoms, which gave forth four neutrons in a chain reaction. 2 billion trillion atoms smashed by 2 billion trillion neutrons in that split second.
The great fireball expanded into a huge mass of churning flames, exactly as it had in the darkness of the New Mexico desert. At the base of the lower part of the mushroom was a dust cloud several hundred feet thick, which covered most of Hiroshima. The mushroom top was a seething, turbulent cloud, which by now was almost at our height. When the blast arrived, we felt the shock waves. There were two short shocks, about 2 seconds apart. It felt like several flak bursts right under the wings.
The bomb did its damage in three ways. First, by blast.
My name is Kleinsorger. I am a Jesuit priest. My mission was in Hiroshima, 1,400 yards from the bomb center. It felt as though the bomb had fallen directly on us. It reminded me of something I had read as a boy, a large meteor colliding with the Earth.
The blast effect alone was equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Then there was the fire effect.
I was 7 years old at the time, and more than 2,000 yards from the target center. I heard nothing, but when I looked up, I saw a sheet of fire, very, very bright and hot, like a great big sun.
For that split second, it was like a sun. 50 million degrees centigrade, three times hotter than the center of the sun. But there was a third kind of death from the bomb, radiation.
My sister and I were 2,000 yards away. My sister seemed quite normal during and after the blast. But week later, she became sick and suddenly died. Doctor said it was radiation.
We think of radiation as the rays you get from radium. There are less than 5 pounds of radium in all the world, where the radiation effect at Hiroshima was equal to several million tons of radium.
Bill, I'm staggered and bewildered by the whole thing. This was all caused by just a few pounds of uranium being banged together?
Yes, Bob. But here is another fantastic point. The Hiroshima bomb was only partially effective. Less than 1 gram of uranium, weighing less than one dime, actually was split and went into action. 78,000 people died at Hiroshima.
The President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans.
You are listening to Chapter 2 of The Quick and the Dead, the NBC document for EAR on the atomic bomb and the possibilities of the new hydrogen bomb. Produced and transcribed by the NBC Newsroom.
And now, Mr. Hope, you know how the first atom bomb was dreamed and built.
Absolutely.
Any questions, Bob?
Only one. How do you make a hydrogen bomb?
That's our next lesson, Bob. We'll take that up next week.
Thanks, Bill. See you next week.
The Quick and the Dead is written and directed by Fred Friendly, supervision William F. Brooks, engineering William Schwartow. Most of the people in tonight's program played themselves, some were impersonated. Much of the material is taken from Mr. Lawrence's book, Dawn Over Zero.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.